Hey, Avani Dice with you. Thanks for listening to the Hack Podcast. When was the first time you got drunk? Researchers say the younger you start taking drugs or drinking alcohol, then the more likely you are to get addicted. So Iceland was facing this problem firsthand, and 20 years ago it had the highest rate of substance abuse among teenagers in Europe. Now they have the lowest rates thanks to a national model. So we'll find out what the secret is and why this model is being rolled out in Australia. Plus, how do we fix an Australian extinction crisis? But first, what's going on with Iran and the US?
President Trump may have pulled back from a military strike on Iran last week, but overnight he imposed another round of sanctions.
On Triple J.
Okay, America and Iran going to war? You could be forgiven for thinking it. There's been a drone shutdown, a cyber attack, hits on oil tankers, and today things got even more tense. Donald Trump ordered direct sanctions or penalties on Iran's supreme leader. Trump's trying to get other countries, including us in Australia, to take measures against Iran as well, in order to pressure the country to bow down to the US. And this is the culmination of decades of problems between the two countries. So Joe Lauder gets us up to speed.
Today, the Trump administration took two significant steps to counter what it says is an escalated threat from Iran.
Tensions have been rising between Iran and America recently. Iran's been blamed for explosions on six oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman. And then last week, Iran shot down an unmanned U.S. drone that it claims was in its airspace, although America denies that.
Unfortunately, that drone was unarmed. We didn't have a man or woman in the drone. We had nobody in the drone.
So on Friday, U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted that he'd been, quote, cocked and loaded to launch a retaliation attack on Iran, but says he stopped the strike when he was told that 150 people would die. U.S. security advisor John Bolton says they instead launched a cyber attack.
Neither Iran nor any other hostile actor should mistake U.S. prudence and discretion for weakness.
Now Trump's announced financial sanctions targeting the supreme leader in Iran and other senior commanders in the regime, so blocking their access to financial assets.
These measures represent a strong and proportionate response to Iran's increasingly provocative actions. We will continue to increase pressure on Tehran.
Look, things have been tense between Iran and the US since the 50s, and there's not enough time in the show to explain it all. But to understand how we got here today, we need to go back to 2015.
After 2 years of negotiations, the United States, together with our international partners, has achieved something that decades of animosity has not.
In 2015, U.S. President Barack Obama signed a landmark agreement with Iran, as well as France, Germany, China, the U.K. and Russia. It's known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or just the Iran nuclear deal.
A comprehensive long-term deal with Iran that will prevent it from obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Under the deal, Iran would back off from developing its nuclear capabilities and have international inspections of its nuclear sites. In exchange, sanctions would be lifted off Iran and it could be part of the global economy. Iran relies on its oil exports, so sanctions cripple its economy. The agreement turned the page on years of hostility and it took a long time to negotiate.
I've been doing deals for a long time. I've been making lots of wonderful deals, great deals. That's what I do.
But Donald Trump was never a fan of the Iran deal because he thought it was too lenient on Iran and, well, because Obama signed it.
Never, ever, ever in my life have I seen any transaction so incompetently negotiated as our deal with Iran.
So Trump officially withdrew America from the Iran nuclear deal last year, despite Iran still abiding by it.
The Europeans in particular have been quite upset about Washington unilaterally dismantling an agreement that took years to come to signature.
That's Dr. Roger Shanahan from the Lowy Institute. Trump also introduced sanctions last year that stop American companies from dealing with Iran or any other company that trades with Iran. That's crippled Iran's economy, which was just bouncing back after years of previous sanctions.
It had a direct effect on the Europeans who were trying to stay in the agreement but made it virtually impossible for them not to fall foul of the sanctions, and so de facto they are party to the sanctions because they can't really trade with the Iranians anymore.
Since then, the Iran-America relationship's gone sour, and no one really knows where things could end up. Iran's announced it's ramping up its stockpiles of enriched uranium again and warned it'll go past the limits set under the deal in 2 days' time.
Iran had been obeying and complying with the agreement and still, until today, is obeying the terms of the agreement.
The UN Security Council's called on the two countries to cool it.
These developments risk miscalculation and conflict. We call for de-escalation and dialogue with full respect for international rules.
Hack, Triple J.
That's Joe Lauder very astutely summarising 60 years of diplomatic tensions into a few minutes for us. And let's get a bit deeper into this. Chaz Licciardello is from the ABC's Planet America, which is all about US politics. He's been looking into this tension with Iran. Chaz, will these sanctions, the threatened drone strikes, all of it force Iran to come to the table? Because I can't really imagine Iran being like, all right, we're going to do what you say now.
Yeah, I can't either. If they were going to come to the table, they would have done it by now. The fact that they haven't shows that they have a bit of pride about this. And this is Iran's history. They've never been very keen to come to the table with America.
Why is that?
Well, I think in the past they haven't really trusted America, and I think the fact that Trump just unilaterally withdrew from the one deal they've had for the first time in decades, I think doesn't help that trust. So, yeah, I don't think they trust America, and I think that they – you got to remember as well, Iran is a democracy, and like it might not seem like that to us, but their people do actually vote, and their people aren't very happy with what America's doing either, and they'd run them out of town if they did a deal right now.
Yeah, that's a good point. What are day-to-day Iranians feeling in this way? You know, and they'll be impacted as well, right?
Absolutely, and they do that. For at least polls from inside Iran suggest they do blame America for the economic warfare that's being waged against them at the moment. So they were the nuclear was popular there, and even though Iran's people tend to be more pro-American than the rest of the Middle East, they're still not loving what's going on at the moment.
Yeah, I saw this tweet from an Iranian man. It says, the only people left to sanction are me, my dad, and our neighbour's kids. The foreign ministry should share Trump's phone number so we can call him and give him our names as well. You know, is there a lot of cynicism among Iranians, do you think?
Look, it does seem that way. It does seem like, because the Americans say that the Iranians don't really like their government very much, and that does also seem to be the case. I don't think the Iranians are very happy in general. I don't think they like their government. I don't think they like the alternatives, and they certainly don't like America while America's starving them. So especially the irony of this situation with the sanctions is that it doesn't actually hurt the people it's meant to hurt, because the IRGC, which is their little army, their revolutionary army, they get their money from smuggling. They get their money from illegal tactics. It has nothing to do with sanctions. So sanctions don't hurt them. It just hurts the people.
On the text line, I think Trump is itching for a war with Iran. He wants to be in office while at war so he can be the commander in chief. And another person says, let's get ready for millions more refugees if Trump goes down this path. You're listening to Hack on Triple J. We're chatting about the US and Iran and the tensions there, Chaz. The big question is, why is this happening? Why is Trump doing this?
I think that Donald Trump, ever since he got in, he didn't like Obama very much. And I think he's trying to replace everything Obama did with basically the same thing, but now branded Trump. I think he wants a Trump nuclear deal that might be like the Obama nuclear.
Right, so he's bringing it all back to scratch and then wants to negotiate peace again.
Yeah,
right.
I think that's what he's trying to do. But the problem is Iran is not playing ball, and I don't think Trump knows why, and he's getting very frustrated about it. He wants to do a deal. He wants to write love letters to them like he did with Kim Jong-un, but they're not writing love letters back. So
yeah.
I think that's the problem.
And just lastly, you know, Trump's pressuring other countries to get involved in these sanctions. What is Australia doing, and are they going to get involved as well?
Well, Australia is certainly not trading with Iran, and I don't think they're about to be. It's very hard for anyone to go against America with these sanctions, because if America says to them, if you deal with Iran, you're not dealing with America, that's just too high a price for any country, unfortunately.
On the text line, isn't this the guy from The Chaser that dressed up as Osama bin Laden?
Yeah, I should know all about the Middle East, shouldn't I?
Chaz Licciardello, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Thanks.
Hack.
You got one part of that wrong. This is not meth.
Triple J.
When you turn on the TV or go to the movies, how many people with a disability do you see on screen? 20% of Australians are living with a disability, but only 4% of characters on our screens have one. But perhaps the worst of these stats is that in the vast majority of these shows, disabled characters aren't played with people by people with a disability. And someone who's trying to change that is RJ Mitty. He's an American actor who you may know as Walter White's son in Breaking Bad. And RJ has cerebral palsy, or CP, and so do all of the characters he plays. He's in a new movie called Standing Up for Sonny, and it's set in Sydney. It's just come out. RJ, thanks for coming on Hack.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us about when you were growing up. Did you see yourself reflected in TV and on movies?
No. I think I had Forrest Gump.
Yeah.
That's a good one, right?
Yeah. Is that the only one you can think of?
It's the only one that really I would ever relate to when it came down to my physical condition having CP. And you know, there was a lot of other projects and stuff that I watched as a kid, but primarily there wasn't a lot of individuals that reflected me. And I think now we're in a time where we can fill that void.
You have cerebral palsy. Yeah. Why did you get into acting?
I did it to meet kids my own age. I didn't know anyone. If you move to Los Angeles and you don't go to school, you don't join a gang, and you don't act, you got no business being in LA. There's nothing else there. And I started acting to meet kids my own age. I was around 12, 13, and just started working as an extra. I was on Hannah Montana, Ari H. Chris, Weeds, Seventh Heaven, and a bunch of other shows and movies, all doing extra work and just auditioning, and turned into a career.
I read that you were sort of looking for roles that involved people with cerebral palsy. Is that true?
Yeah, my agents were, because, you know, I would go into auditions and they would be like, what's wrong with you? Like, is there something off? Because I wouldn't tell them I had CP in the beginning. And I'd be like, oh, yes, by the way, I have cerebral palsy. And they'd be like, oh, okay. And they were getting kickback or fussed from someone, and they're like, well, let's see if we can find more roles that highlight his disability and highlight cerebral palsy. And they were looking, and magically Breaking Bad was being created at the same time, and the breakdown was mild CP, big eyebrows, and I'm like, well, I got both of those.
Yeah, it was made for you. So that was obviously, you know, a really big role for you. What was it like being in such a TV show like that, reflecting living with a disability?
Primarily, a lot of it, I wasn't trying to reflect a disability. You know, for me, when I create these characters, the disability is fourthary. Like, it's so down the list of secondaries. And I try to do my best to not make that the focal point, and just make it a part of existence, a part of life, because that's really all it is. And everyone's going through these things, and we're all going through these different pieces, and maybe it's physical, maybe it's mental, or otherwise, but we all have this thing, and we have to show the humanity of it and not just make it a highlight.
Yeah, I think a lot of people relate to it. I certainly do, because you don't want to be hired for something because of your identity or, yeah, you know, your life or, you know, your diversity, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a weird business we're in, entertainment, because at the same time, that is a big ploy. That is a big market. And people are like, oh, now more than ever, we want that. And at the same time, how do you not get drowned by an identity of a social movement or a social cause or social justice, whatever that may be? Like, how do you not lose your individuality in a masses? And, you know, I think it's very tricky, but I find everyone that lives in a diverse world has such a strong individuality that they can't, but we do lose sight, and we have to remember to be who we want to be and that we need to be.
We're talking to American actor RJ Mitty, who played Walter White Jr. in Breaking Bad. Lucy on the text line, Glee was great, although the actor who played Artie wasn't a quadriplegic himself. The actress who played Becky did have Down syndrome. Another person, shout out to Michael J. Fox, repping persons with disability on the big screen. And another person, I love The Heights on ABC and its teenage character with a disability. I love that her disability isn't focused on as much as her relationships. That's a good point. I want to hear from you. Text me 0439757555. Can you think of characters who do have a disability? RJ, in Australia, around 20% of people are living with a disability, but only 4% of actors in our TV shows and in our movies have one. Is that good enough?
No. Why would that be good enough? Nothing's good enough. We always want more. At the end of the day, we deserve more. Everyone deserves more, disabled or not. You should have an accurate reflection of good quality television and good quality medias and formats that people can be represented. We're almost in 2020, and it's like we are so far ahead technologically and socially and communicatively, but at the same time, we're so backwards.
What needs to change?
I wish I knew. Because I would do it tomorrow. I think if anyone knew, they would change it tomorrow. But, you know, I think getting your voice out, having individuals tell their stories, just like I'm doing, and continuing those echoes and continuing to tell those stories and registering and changing that mindset so our future generations and their future generations evolve from this conversation.
RJ Mitty, thank you so much for coming on Hack.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Hack. Triple J.
That's RJ Mitty. Ellie in Sydney, you say, I saw Standing Up for Sunny at the Sydney Film Festival and loved it. That's RJ's new film. RJ's character had so much depth over and above the normal token disabled character. It was secondary to his personality and didn't define him. Another person, I'm dyslexic and it's shit because of how hard it is to get officially diagnosed and it makes it hard holding down a job. And another person, good on ya, RJ. Breaking Bad was the first show I watched where a character with a disability wasn't dealt with in a ham-fisted or tokenistic way.
Drug education is fine, but that alone does not work.
On Triple J.
If you smoke, drink, or take drugs, how old were you when you first started doing that? Well, the younger you start, the more likely you are to become addicted. So tackling high rates of drinking and drug use among young people is a good way to deal with that problem, right? And that's what Iceland did. 20 years ago, it had the highest rates of substance abuse among teenagers in Europe. Today, it's got the lowest rate. And Australia is now rolling out this Nordic scheme at 10 places around the country. The program's called Planet Youth. Let's find out how it works. Jon Sigfusson is the director, and he's in Australia to help these Aussie towns with the program. Jon, thanks for coming on Hack.
It's a pleasure.
How bad was the drug and alcohol situation among young people in Iceland before this program began?
We had a really serious problem in around 1998. Icelandic adolescents, they scored the highest in the use of drugs in Europe. That is, if we look at 10th grade, 15, 16-year-old, they scored the highest in the use of alcohol, cannabis and tobacco.
What was driving those high rates of use?
In Iceland, there was a very liberal attitude towards children's drinking, and that was driving it partly.
So when you say a liberal attitude, do you mean that children could easily get drugs and alcohol and their parents were allowing them to get it?
Yeah, and parents really, they didn't know as much as they do today. I mean, now you know the dangers of starting to use alcohol early. 20 years ago, we didn't know that if you start using alcohol at the age of 15, you are four times more likely to become an alcoholic later in life, for example. We didn't know the effects of alcohol on the brain. Now we do. So there is a lot of knowledge that we have today and we didn't have then.
And what were the main approaches to tackling the issue? Was it mainly educating people around drug and alcohol use?
That is correct. Before 98, we had been educating children, young people, telling them how to, you know, say no to drugs and be responsible for their own well-being. But we turned this around in 98 and decided to start educating parents, which was the most important thing. And also we started creating a lot of activities for children, young people. So now all young people in our country, they have a very good access to all sorts of extracurricular activities, sports, art, whatever they want to do. And that's all organized and quality controlled and subsidized by the municipalities.
Yeah, it's interesting because in Australia, one of the main national approaches to tackling this issue is drug education. What was not working about that tactic in Iceland?
Drug education is fine, but that alone does not work. You have to change the environment of young people so that they are in lesser risk of starting to use substances.
And at what point in Iceland did researchers like you and your colleagues decide this is not right, something really has to change?
In its simplest term, what we've done in Iceland, everybody who's working on prevention, is trying to strengthen the preventive factors and weaken the risk factors. Strengthen the preventive factors, teach parents, make sure young people have all sorts of opportunities to use their free time. Risk factors, we saw, for example, like hanging out late at night, doing nothing was a risk factor. So we have changed that. Children are coming home much earlier than they did. Children who were bullied, they were more likely to start using drugs. So we put a lot of emphasis into allowing children to feel better at school. So a lot of initiatives, programs, campaigns.
You're listening to Hack on Triple J. We're chatting to Jon Sigfusson. He's the director of a program called Planet Youth, which has worked over the last 20 years in Iceland to curb rates of substance abuse among young people. And one big part of this model is giving every teenager a card, which has 400 euros on it to cover the cost of joining a sports club or an activity. Tell us how that works.
Yeah, it's money that's the municipalities, they give this money out. And you sit down in front of a computer, you register. If you want to play, let's say, basketball this year, you register to a basketball club close to you. And when you attend that club, the money goes from the municipality to the basketball club. And you can divide this if you want to play music or do art or something.
Why is it important for young people to do activities like music, art, sport? How does that stop them from taking drugs or drinking excessive amounts of alcohol from a really young age?
One of the biggest risk factors is if children have nothing to do and they are bored. So what the municipalities have done in Iceland is reverse that and make sure that young people have plenty of opportunities, be it, as I say, in sports, art, music, whatever. So that is a huge preventive factor, and this is what the municipalities are supporting.
You've been asking countries around the world to adopt this model. Why do you think it can benefit us here in Australia?
I'm very confident that the local communities that have decided to do a pilot, very confident that they will be able to make use of this methodology.
But Australia is very different to Iceland, isn't it? We're a lot bigger. We're a really diverse community. Do you think it'll work here?
I do. Reason is, the size of the country is not what's most important. We are working now in more than 20 countries in more than 100 cities. And the reason is that we are always working on a local level. So if you take a municipality, divide that up into districts, then you have a smaller unit, and that's where the focus should be. Also, we have been working in different countries with totally different cultures than the one we have in our country. And there also we see that this methodology is working.
Jon Sigfusson, thanks for joining us on Hack.
Thank you.
Hack on Triple J.
That's Jon Sigfusson from Planet Youth in Iceland, and that program is going to be rolled out at 10 places around the country, including Marrickville in New South Wales, Hepburn in Victoria, and Huon Valley in Tassie. On the text line, I started smoking when I was 13, and it's more harder than ever to quit because of how much of a habit it is.
Hack. Up to 1 million species of plants and animals are at risk of extinction.
On Triple J.
If you had to choose an Australian animal to go extinct, which one would it be? I know it's a horrible question to think about, but that's the position scientists say they're in right now. Australia has the highest rate of mammal extinction in the world, but scientists say they're forced to pick which animals to rescue because we're only funding a tenth of what is needed to protect them. And jobs for a region appear to be coming before species. Shalala Medora has the story.
We are in an extinction crisis, and it's real.
Four Corners last night on animals going extinct was a depressing watch. It outlined Australia's dubious honour as one of the world's worst offenders.
Our wildlife is our heritage. Our wildlife is who we are. We in Australia are very proud of our wildlife, but we don't protect them properly.
And scientists say we're not doing enough to turn around this human-induced crisis.
There's no real sign of it abating in the near future, and if we want it to stop, we're going to have to do a lot more than we're currently doing.
There are 1,800 plants and animals on the threatened species list in Australia. Just a few months ago, in February, we lost a small brown rat called the Bramble K. melomus.
Sadly, the Bramble K. melomus is now listed as extinct.
Rising sea levels as a result of climate change had made the small rodent's habitat on an island in the Great Barrier Reef inhospitable.
Our system for protecting threatened species in this country is fundamentally broken. And we don't have the laws in place that protect their critical habitats, and we're certainly not investing anywhere near enough money in their recovery.
The problem is it actually takes a lot of resources to keep species in the game. So we're currently spending about a tenth on what we need to spend to actually conserve all of our threatened species that are on our threatened species list.
In other words, we're spending a dollar on conservation when we should be spending 10.
It's not about waving a checkbook at the levels of threatened species. It's about sensible funding, which we do.
Susan Lee was named Environment Minister following the federal election. Four Corners asked her if the federal government was doing enough.
I'm not passing the buck to the states. I'm simply saying that this is not something the federal government can do alone.
Volunteers are stepping up to do the work because they say governments aren't.
So if volunteers like us weren't doing it, it just wouldn't be done and the animals would be going extinct.
The conservationists are monitoring species loss and keeping an eye on illegal clearing and logging.
By far the biggest threat is habitat loss and modification. So the areas that we're clearing for food production, to grow cities and so forth, they're really taking a very heavy toll on species. Invasive species as well has had a devastating effect on our wildlife. Pollution, so of course the case of microplastics and the pollution in the oceans is well established.
And that's the rub. Animals are going extinct because of the way humans are living our lives.
Do we really want to put Australian Paper's Merivale Mill out of work?
And there doesn't seem to be much political will to change things.
And we will not destroy our regional communities by ridiculous green ideology with absolutely no basis.
Politicians are fond of saying it's one or the other, jobs or the environment. But as conservationists point out, when animals go extinct, it affects everyone and everything.
We're talking about a potential existential threat to humanity. So we really need governments to really step up to the plate, draw a line in the sand and say enough is enough.
It's not just going to threaten the plants and animals, but we are an interconnected ecosystem, and it's going to actually start having knock-on effects to us as well and our society.
Hack. Triple J.
Shalala Medora reporting, and ecologists say there are really simple solutions to deal with this extinction crisis. Dr. Ewan Ritchie is one of them. He's from Deakin University and joins us now. Ewan, what's going wrong here?
Well, there's lots going wrong, unfortunately. We're losing species at an incredibly rapid rate. So we're getting up close to 2,000 threatened species and threatened communities. We've already lost, caused the extinction of more than 30 mammals since European settlement, and the list goes on.
And how do we fix this problem?
There are a number of things we need to do. We need a rapid and immediate increase in funding of protection of our species to at least 2% of GDP. So at the moment we spend, from a dollar of taxpayer money, about 5 cents on on-ground conservation actions, which is absolutely appalling when you think about the incredible diversity we have in this country, most of which is unique around the world, so it's not found anywhere else, and yet we're spending an incredibly small amount of money on protecting those,
you and
those
the, species. The thing is, though, we saw in the election that people are preferencing their livelihoods, jobs, industry and all of that over things like protecting the environment. How do you propose we change public perception so people care more about this issue and consequently politicians do something about it?
Well, I think there's really a false argument being made that it's jobs versus the environment. So as an example, we saw the Adani mine being put ahead of, say, the protection of a finch species. Now, actually, if we use that same money that's been poured into trying to get Adani off the ground and pour that into renewable jobs, as an example, we'd see many more jobs and a more prosperous economy and, of course, less impact in terms of climate change. And so we really need to question these arguments about it's jobs versus the environment. We also know, of course, that the environment itself provides huge amounts of money through things like tourism, but also ecosystem services. So it keeps our air clean, our waterways, provides water, provides a whole range of services for us free of charge. And we're absolutely pillaging that environment and seeing it being degraded, which is going to cost us a lot of money to try and replace those services, if we can at all.
All right, Dr. Ewan Ritchie, thank you so much for your time. On the text line, a lot of you are choosing animals to go extinct, which I know is a joke. People saying emus, the cane toads, wombats, but hopefully we can do more to protect these species, like Dr. Ewan Ritchie has just said.
Hack.
On Triple J.
Heaps of texts coming in about the extinction crisis in Australia. Someone says, if the animals in Australia got to vote on one species to go extinct, we'd undoubtedly be chosen. Humans, no intelligent species would destroy their only home, planet and wildlife, and yet we do every day. Sophie in Brisbane says, imagine imagine all the tourism we'd lose if we lost the Great Barrier Reef and the koala. And another person, been watching this closely and it's breaking my heart. I work with dingo awareness and protection, and the government input and public mentality are disgusting. Yeah, really interesting chat there. I'll catch you tomorrow.